morning. Please be seated. All right, we only have one more case on our 9 o'clock docket in the interest of AC. And let's see, we have Luisa Moreno, is that correct?
Marrero, yes, ma'am.
Marrero, all right. And you're going to argue, apparently Mr. Barber is still not here, is that correct? All right, well, if you'll approach the bench, then we'll hear your presentation. And you may do as much or as little of it as you like today.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The issue in this case is the mom's appeal, and it's whether or not the trial court's severance of the petition and intervention affected her case, not the case of the intervener. I would like to bring forth that the department is interested in the due process issue raised by the appellant, and there is no due process issue involved in this case, as there is no harm. This court has decided, and Justice Livingston, you wrote the opinion in Aviation Composite Technologies, that a trial court is authorized to sever claims on its own motion. Further, the court held that we find no authority indicating that prior notice is required of a trial court's decision to sever a claim. Further, the court also found that the trial court is not required to hold an evidentiary hearing prior to severing a claim. That takes care of the appellant's first issue regarding due process. The standard of review in this case is abuse of discretion, and in Womack versus Berry, a Supreme Court case from 1956, the Supreme Court held that the rules of civil procedure bestow upon the trial court broad discretion on issues regarding severance and consolidation, and therefore these procedural matters will not be disturbed by an appellate court except for an abuse of discretion. Further, in Guarantee Federal Savings Bank versus Horseshoe Operating Corporation, that case set forth how to determine whether a claim is properly severable. The first issue is whether or not there is more than one cause of action, and in this case, there are. We have the department's position that termination of the mother's parental rights is at issue. The intervener sought to adopt the child, or in the alternative, to be awarded permanent managing conservator of the case. Thus, prong one is met. The second portion of Guarantee Federal requires that a claim be allowed as properly filed as an independent and separate lawsuit. In this case, the intervener had standing under Texas Family Code 102.003, Section 12, which allows that a foster parent who has a child in its care for 12 months file an original petition within 90 days of the child's removal from its care. Thus, prong two of Guarantee Federal is met. The final prong of Guarantee Federal requires that the claims be not so interwoven as to include the same facts and issues. The relief requested by the department, again, is termination. The relief requested by the intervener was adoption or, in the alternative, permanent managing conservator. In Texas Department of Human Services versus EB, the sole question in a parental termination case is whether a predicate ground is found and whether or not the case is whether or not best interest was proven beyond clear and convincing evidence. And we have both of those met in this case. The appellant argues that the claims are interwoven because the intervener was an indispensable party to the lawsuit. They claim that their trial strategy was thwarted because of the trial court's sua sponte severance of the petition and intervention. Unfortunately, the appellant did not raise trial strategy under TRAC Rules 33.1. They did not preserve error for the trial court. So the trial court cannot have abused discretion in severing the petition when they did not know about the trial strategy that the appellant is claiming.
Was there a motion for continuance?
No, ma'am, there was not. There was the original trial that started September 30th of 08, and then due to issues with the associate judge, it was there was a mistrial, and it was reset for October 3rd of 2008. The next issue regarding trial strategy, should the court consider that properly preserved, was that the appellant had every opportunity to bring forth the issues that the intervener claims that they would have added to the case, but the appellant chose not to do so. The intervener was questioned by the appellant's attorney. But the appellant's attorney did not ask about whether or not the intervener thought termination was in the best interest of the child. They did not ask about the mother's parenting abilities. All they focused on was the intervener's past actions as the foster mother for the child in this case. An offer of proof was made to the court after all evidence was heard, explaining why the evidence of the intervener was necessary. And in doing so, the offer of proof focused solely on the intervener's actions as a foster mother. They brought forth a doctor to say the foster mother had never neglected the child. They brought forth evidence regarding the reasons why the child was removed from the foster mother's care. But again, no evidence was offered regarding the mother in this case, her parenting abilities, termination, or even an alternate placement option in lieu of termination. And the appellants argue that because the petition was intervention, the petition and intervention was severed, that the trial court's options were limited. And in the Family Code under 153.005B, the trial court is allowed to name any competent adult as managing conservator for a child in this case.
I would ask you about that. Do you think that statute really means that the trial court could appoint someone out there as managing conservator even if they're not a party before the court in that case?
Yes, ma'am.
Like, could he appoint me as managing conservator?
Yes, ma'am.
Even though I'm not there and I'm not a party, would it be binding on me?
It would. And the next issue brought forth by the appellant was the factual sufficiency of the best interest evidence. And I would point to the fact that there were two witnesses testifying that there is no bond between mother and child, that the mother had a lackluster visitation record throughout the pendency of the case. She visited the child four times, with the fourth occurring the day before the trial, that mother failed to complete any of the services offered, and mother failed to provide for any of the child's medical needs. And this court held an In Re MW back in 2008, which was a wound care case, that failure to meet the needs of a child regarding wound care, excuse regarding transportation as a excuse for not providing medical attention, were no excuses. And in MW, the court held that because Medicaid had provided additional dollars for mother to seek medical attention for her child and she failed to do so, that was evidence regarding termination and best interest. And we have that same issue in this case. We also have mother's drug use during pregnancy of the child. She also admitted to using marijuana while pregnant with her last child, who was born in 2007. And so we further have a conviction for robbery, and we have the foster parents who are currently meeting the needs of the child and want to adopt the child. So therefore, the evidence is factually sufficient to meet the best interest requirements.
Doesn't that create a conflict of interest when you have people coming in who are supposed to be providing temporary care for the child, but in reality, they're just trying to set up an adoption?
Well, the process that the state allows for is called foster adoptive homes, that they are both, that they foster children.
I understand that. I understand the state allows it because we see it time after time after time. But when this was originally set up, the foster care was supposed to be totally divorced from anybody who had an interest in a permanent relationship with that child, so there wasn't a conflict between the parents. The natural parents or whatever parents existed and the foster care, but now you've got people whose intent is to adopt and they have every interest in destroying the relationship between the current parent so that they can adopt. Isn't that an awful conflict of interest that's been created by the way we're doing things? Parents who can't go through Gladney, can't go through the agencies for whatever reason, because they don't qualify for whatever reason, are now becoming foster parents for the purpose of adopting. You don't think that's a conflict of interest?
I don't, Your Honor, because the department makes the decisions on whether or not adoption will happen, and that's done through the service plans, which set out the goals, the permanency goals for the child.
How many times does the department say a foster parent who has had the child and wants to adopt cannot adopt?
I was actually involved in a case this year where we had that, and we sought reunification with the parents and not adoption or termination to allow the foster parents to adopt.
But when there isn't reunification with the parent, has there ever been a case when the foster parents were not allowed to adopt, but the child went to somebody else?
I'm sure there has, but I cannot.
But you don't know of a single
specific
one, do you?
No, I do not, ma'am.
And that can be in place of relatives. I mean, that's what we see. We see instead of relatives, it goes to the foster parents.
Well, in our due diligence efforts, our goal is to prevent removal, which is by seeking other placements for the child prior to taking them into care. So we do focus on the placement, referral placement form, which we give and which parents are to fill out, to name relatives as options. And home studies are done so that we can place in families, if appropriate, rather than bringing a child into foster care. And again, I thank you for your time. I just want to be clear that because they raised the due process issue, we felt it important to be able to express how this is not a due process cause of action. There are no due process claims here because, again, there was no harm. The appellant was in no way prevented from putting forth her case. The trial strategy that they are claiming in this case was not precluded because of the severance. Again, the witness, the intervener was brought on as a witness, was questioned by the appellant's attorney, and no issues regarding options to placement or termination alternatives were brought forth. Therefore, there is no harm and there is no due process complaint. And we would ask that the court affirm the trial court. If there are no other questions, thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Marrero. We appreciate your arguments today and your briefing. We appreciate y'all coming up from Austin as well.
Thank you.
Your case is submitted and you're excused. The clerk will now adjourn us.